You're tuned to WEOS Geneva, WXXE Fenner Syracuse, W201CD Ithaca Community Radio, or Free Radio Santa Cruz. This is Unwelcome Guests. You're listening to a lecture and discussion by Peter Lamborn Wilson on spiritual anarchism. We continue.
Oh yeah, the spiritualists, I've got them here. Sebastian Frank was one, Caspar Schwenkfeld, and Paracelsus. Those were the three, but there were others as well. Then there was the Radical Reformation, who were perhaps not exactly Protestant either. I'm thinking of the Anabaptists and the Bible Communists, the people whose descendants now live in America as Amish and Mennonites, who have all things in common and live the common life together as sort of married monks, you might say, married monks and nuns. This has biblical foundation. The early church practiced community of goods. It says so right in St. Paul. There's no way that the church or any right wing within the church can deny this. They can always say, well, it was temporary, things changed, but there was a moment when the early church itself was communist. And this moment is then rediscovered again and again and again, especially in the 16th century, especially in Northern Europe, for the most part. And it's this tradition which then moves through through time and reaches the 17th century and inspires some of the great movements of the English Civil War, which I'll get to in a minute. Meanwhile, we have other groups such as the Libertines, who were not exactly, you know, sexual libertines, although the Marquis de Sade, but were another kind of antinomian, quasi-Protestant heresy. You have the Family of Love, who were kind of a secret society, who practiced mysticism and were very non-authoritarian. They moved from Germany into Holland, eventually into England. So that's the link between your 16th century ultra-Protestants, so to speak, and the 17th century sect of the Civil War era is the Family of Love. It's a very key and interesting group on which very little work has been done. We have the Rosicrucians, who appeared around 1620, 1617, 1620, with their idea of radical tolerance, as I call it. they were basically saw themselves again as a force that would be neither Roman nor Lutheran nor Calvinist, but something else, something more liberatory, based in this case on Hermeticism and occultism. Alchemy and the idea of alchemical healing, which they had inherited from Paracelsus, and this they published anonymous manifestos, which caused a big stir in Europe, and pretty much nothing came of it because immediately the whole project failed as far as its politics were concerned, with the beginning of the 30 Years' War, which was one of the most disgusting wars in the whole disgusting history of war. As it was in fact a religious war, not even in pretense, but in fact a religious war, with Protestants and Catholics slaughtering each other for 30 years all over Northern Europe. And this put an end to the Rosicrucian dream. You can read about this in Francis Yates, F-R-A-N-C-E-S, Yates, Y-A-T-E-S, The Rosicrucian Enlightenment, a brilliant book, very brilliant book. Then we have the German mystics, which I mentioned briefly earlier, Meister Eckhart, Tauler, Suso. Later on, we have Jakob Boehme, the Hermetic Pietists. We have Jane Ledd, one of the interesting women leaders of this movement in London. These people are not at all political, generally, unless they're forced to be. They're really quietist, separatist, mystic types. But just because of that, they get in trouble with the church. Eckhart was almost excommunicated. If he hadn't died before the church got around to trying him, he probably would have been excommunicated. Finally, we get to the English Revolution. Here I would recommend very strongly Christopher Hill, The World Turned Upside Down, sort of standard work on the wacky Protestant sects of the Civil War, and to a certain extent J.P. Thompson, another British Marxist historian. I like them both very, very much. Groups such as the Diggers, the Ranchers, the Levelers, the Seekers, the Fifth Monarchy Men, the Muggletonians, early Quakers, Antinomians. The Diggers were agrarian radicals. Gerard Winstanley was their leader, wrote beautiful books They tried to have a commune outside London. They were crushed by Cromwell. Not by the king, but by Cromwell. They were, it was part of Cromwell's, the inevitable counter-revolution, you might say, is that the really interesting, really radical Protestant sects in the 1640s were looked on as a danger to the Commonwealth under Cromwell. So that it was Cromwell who bored hot irons through the tongues of the of early Quakers like John Naylor. It was Cromwell who had diggers and ranters executed or put in the stocks or exiled to Jamaica or Barbados. It was Cromwell was, in this sense, a Stalin, if you like. That's a vast oversimplification, and I apologize for it. But it's, nevertheless, it's true. There was a counter-revolutionary aspect to the Civil War. Once the heretics got in power, they weren't heretics anymore. They were the orthodoxy. And so anyone who became heretical in relation to them was in even worse trouble than they had been before. Because nobody knew, the old, you know, Bishop, Archbishop Laud and these kind of people didn't even know the difference between a ranter and a leveler. But the Cromwellians did. They were their, you know, they were their comrades in the army. They knew exactly who they were and they knew exactly what they were saying, which was down with government. So, especially the diggers, ranters, and levelers. The seekers, for example, Roger Williams was a seeker, the founder of Rhode Island. These were people who took a wait-and-see attitude, literally. They were waiting on the Lord. They knew there was something wrong with all the existing churches, but they didn't know what. So they were seeking. But they organized as such to a certain extent. The Fifth Monarchy men and the Muggletonians were kind of late manifestation of this millenarian madness that Christopher Hill describes so beautifully in his book, the idea of the imminence of the end of the world, which at the same time is the return of the Golden Age. The end of the millennium is also the return of the Golden Age. This myth comes from classical antiquity and is completely englobed into the whole of Christian European culture as a sub-theme which appears over and over and over again, and probably most recently in the communist movement, which very definitely had millenarian aspects. He's talking about the coming of perfection on the level of physical reality. So this is a fine old tradition, if you like, whether you like it or not. It's very much part of our heritage and needs to be thought about. By the way, William Blake's mother was a Muggletonian, as discovered by E.P. Thompson in his last fascinating little book on Blake, which I recommend. So Blake was not only in interested in Swedenborg and the other crazy mysticisms of his day, he actually belonged to this 1640 tradition by virtue of his own family connections. From there we kind of move on. All right, we move on to more or less late 16th, early 17th century, what I call left-wing Freemasonry. In 1717, you get the founding of the Grand Lodge of Freemasonry in London at the Apple Tree Tavern, about three doors down from Blake's house, by the way, where later on the Order of Druids was also refounded. Actually, later on that year, the Order of Druids was refounded. The Order of Druids acquired quite a lot of free thinkers and radicals, including Blake, probably, Paine, who wrote an essay, if you don't believe me, it's in his collected works, called Druid Freemasonry, in which he praises it to the skies, and quite a lot of the free thinkers at the time. It's a very complex and interesting subject, Druidism in the 18th century, which I've tried to, I've got an essay in my forthcoming, God willing, book on history of New York State, because the Druids had a big impact here in Newburgh, New York, up the river, up the Hudson River. There was a, and in New York City. And all of them were totally freaky radical Freemasons. I mean, you know, way to the left of Jefferson. You know? And they were Paineites, basically. They were followers of Paine, who suggested a temple of reason, a philanthropic temple of a religion of reason. Okay? An idea which seems completely paradoxical to us now, looking back without perfect hindsight, looking back on the Enlightenment. How could there be a religion of reason? Well, Thomas Paine suggested it. They had one here in New York, they had one in Philadelphia, and they had one in Newburgh, New York, so, which I've tried to write about. John Tolland, the 17th century philosopher, Mason, rogue Mason to be sure, and author of one of the very first books on Druidism, was a key figure here, as was Blake himself, of course. As I've said here, William Blake, sine qua non, without which nothing. You know, Blake is really, in my view, the linchpin of this whole list. Going on from there, we would come into Romanticism, especially the left wing of German and English Romanticism, which sort of collapsed as a result of the Terror and the Napoleonic takeover. It's very much like many elements of leftism collapsed in Europe and America when the crimes of Stalin became clear. Also, when the crimes of the French Revolution began to become clear, many of the people who had supported it vigorously, especially young romantics like Wordsworth and Coleridge, turned their backs on it. And some of them went so far as later on to become out-and-out reactionaries, I would say, certainly Coleridge. Much as I admire him, there's no doubt that he ended up very much on the right. Others never gave up, either because they died too early or killed themselves in dismay. But there has always been a left wing of Romanticism, even amongst those who look back to the Middle Ages and are thought to be so reactionary. After all, that is a perfect description of William Morris, a socialist anarchist who looked back to the Middle Ages, the Christian Middle Ages, as the as his model for a perfect society. Read News from Nowhere by Morris, one of the most important British anarchist thinkers. Okay. We could mention here Thoreau and Emerson in particular, and my own favorite, Stephen Pearl Andrews, another New York eccentric anarchist who founded the commune Modern Times in Brentwood, Long Island, and was had a very distinct religious side to him. He founded his own church and was involved in spiritualism. He was one of the many, many people, radical people in the 19th century who were involved in seances with summoning up spirits of dead people. Again, something which seems so incomprehensible to us, unless we look at it from the point of view, as one American historian said, there is no new age. There never has been a new age, because there was always a new age before it. And in this case, we have the 1850s, which is certainly everything that came out in the 1960s and 70s was already there in potentia, and maybe even more fully realized in some fields in the 1840s and 50s. Fourierism, German communism and socialism coming in. You had Native American anarchism of the individualist Josiah Warren, Benjamin Tucker type. You had every kind of utopian idea from Icaria, John Humphrey Noyes, Oneida, commune in upstate New York. Upstate New York was very active in this period. It was the California of the 19th century New Age, you might say. All right, I'm getting to the end here, so don't despair. I just wanted to go on to quickly mention, the religion of nature and the Native American influence, Thoreau, his fascination with Native American spirituality. Then moving on into very late 19th century, early 20th century Romanticism, if I can call it that. People like Gustav Landauer, the great anarchist philosopher who was murdered by the proto-Nazis after the fall of the Munich Soviet in 1919. And his friends Gershom Scholem and Walter Benjamin, two Jewish philosophers who were both anarchists. In fact, Benjamin was a Marxist, but also an anarchist. And once somebody asked him why he never joined the party, meaning the Communist Party. And he said, I guess it's because of my old anarchism. And Scholem, who was a great scholar of Kabbalistic heresy, was an active Jewish anarchist in the line of Martin Buber. Buber would never made the leap to anarchism quite himself. He was very sympathetic towards it. So we have that whole German romantic Jewish leftism to consider. Also, again, I find it very much a lost area of discourse, because it isn't supposed to exist in the view of a lot of Orthodox historians. Then going on from there, Surrealism. We know that the Surrealists were fascinated with Hermeticism and with Oriental religion, with African religion, everything except Christianity. They would always spit on a Catholic priest, but they had great interest in African fetish masks, for example, or in Giordano Bruno in the Hermeticists. Onto the side of them, I would mention Roger Calois, Georges Bataille, and the Collège de Sociologie, a short-lived, killed off by the Second World War, group of intellectuals in Paris who were very open minds about everything. Some people, I guess, would say their minds were so open their brains fell out. But they did. There's a book now called The College of Sociology in English, which has translated about 30 or 40 of the most brilliant papers that were given there. And many of the themes that we've dealt with here would come out in their work. And then moving up to the 1960s, I think it gets to be pretty obvious now. You see where I'm going here. The return of shamanism, you know, the rebirth of the archaic revival, as Terence McKenna called it, the spiraling around. You know, there's, everyone always says, there's no turning back the clock. This is always an excuse meaning shut up and put up with reality as I say it. No. This is what capitalists tell you. There's no turning back the clock. Well, it's true there's no turning back the clock, but sometimes things return on their own in this spiraling model of history. You reach that same axis again at a different time and in a different way. And in my experience, this is what the 60s comprised when we discovered psychedelics, blew our minds, new left politics combined with psychedelics, and a growing appreciation for tribal shamanistic cultures that were dying out, disappearing around the world, fascination with Oriental mysticism and Christian heresies and so forth. Even the Diggers reappeared in San Francisco in 1967 or 66. So I think you see what I'm aiming at there, the psychedelic cults. All this is perhaps important, or perhaps it isn't. If what I'm saying has any validity at all, I think it's very important. If what I'm saying is a load of horse shit, then the 60s was, you know, just silly. Point 11, the critique of civilization needs a strong science of its own. Post-Enlightenment science with its dead matter, crypto-metaphysics, needs a revolution, a Kuhnian revolution, if you're familiar with Thomas Kuhn, the guy who invented the idea of the scientific paradigm. We need a restitution of meaning. We need a re-enchantment of the landscape, if you'll allow me to say so. We need not just a Sorelian myth, George Sorel, but a real myth. We need surrealist, surrationalist, surregionalist subversion, which requires potent, earth-centered spirituality, a Gaia hypothesis that's more than merely hypothetical, a spiritual experience of the earth as a living being, ecstasy as enstasy. Okay, ecstasy means actually literally means outside, the standing outside, i.e., of the body. Enstasy would mean standing inside the body. So what I'm trying to do is conflate these two terms and say that that ecstasy is enstasy. It's not an escape from the physicality. It's a kind of ultimate bestowal of meaning on physicality. Here I would refer you to the Russian philosopher Bakhtin and his work on the idea of celebration, on the Dionysiac moment of intoxication on the social scale. What's the name of his great book again? Bakhtin's, it's a book about Rabelais.
Rabelais and his world.
He takes off from the great French, late medieval French writer, Rabelais. Festival consciousness as magic is the way I've phrased it. In this context, Hermeticism might recommend itself because of its rectified Neoplatonic view of matter as spirit, the doctrine of earth as a living being. This was very clear in the Renaissance Hermeticists. Nicholas of Cusa, who was himself a bishop of the church, was the first one to express this in modern times. It's a kind of twisting around of Platonism. I mean, Platonism talks about emanations and about the shadows in the cave and all this kind of thing. The implication is that material reality is on a lesser level than spiritual reality. What Cusa and Bruno and Ficino and the other great Renaissance Hermeticists do is turn that idea somewhat on its head and give Earth a new centrality, a new dignity. It's in Pico della Mirandola's famous oration on the dignity of man, which many people see as the founding document of the modern world. I would say that if we're looking for a religion, you know, for a spiritual framework or even just flavoring, you know, for our environmental ecological side of our struggle, we could scarcely do better than to revive some of these old Renaissance magi who have a complete metaphysics of the living earth, the dignity of matter itself, the centrality of material, the fact that matter and spirit are really one, yeah, really are one, not just a matter of speaking, but literally are one. So I would say Hermeticism is not a religion, but a science of spirit and imagination. It's meant to be empirical, experiential, and experimental. Historically, it's closer to us than shamanism or the Oriental ways. It's culturally familiar, although, of course, it's also strange. It's always strange. It's compatible with Christian, Jewish, Islamic, and Hindu mysticism, probably also with Taoism and Buddhism, certainly with Rosicrucianism and Masonry, and with most of the great heresies. So, in fact, I'm very interested in radical Hermeticism now, and you might say that's that's one of the lines I intend to pursue myself out of this whole list of possibilities. Finally, I don't want to argue for anarchist spirituality or spiritual anarchism. On principle, I don't want to argue this way. I say, by their fruits shall ye know them, to quote that book. Research here means participation, a willingness to hallucinate and be swept away beyond the censor of enlightened reason, perhaps even into the demonic, psychonauts in psychic bathyspheres. Thank you.
And now we go to the question and answer and back and forth. Could you people in the back keep it down a little? Just spend money quietly, please.
A famous mathematician and logician called Kurt Gödel.
Yes.
And he has a theory that there are statements in mathematics which are true but not provable.
Yes.
But I think if they're false, you could find counterexamples. So it's not just a matter of what's true and false is the same as what's provable and unprovable. That might feed into this gap between meaningful and meaningless in some abstract way.
I think it probably does.
There are another ways beyond meaningful and meaningless.
I haven't read Hofstadter, so I don't know whether he's onto that idea or not, but some people are onto that idea of Gödel.
Yeah, Hofstadter was now depressed. After he wrote Gödel, Escherbach, he seems to have gone downhill. But in Gödel, Escherbach, he talks about that you need circular connections between different hierarchies of things to create meaning. A certain angle on the subject.
Yeah, absolutely. Your point is well taken. I have nothing to add to that. Yeah. Yes.
In recent decades, there's been a lot of interest in Gnosticism, like Lynn Pagel's Gnostic Gospels, the Philip K. Dick material, and other authors dealing with that. To what extent has this developed as a congregation or a spiritual practice? Like, are there any Christian churches that accept the Gospel of Thomas or some of this other material?
Yeah.
And what's the main...
The question is there a modern-day equivalent of Gnostic dualism? Are there any Christian or other churches that have adopted some of these ideas? There was reference was made to the science fiction writer Philip K. Dick, who used made marvelous use of Gnostic dualist ideas in his writing. Harold Bloom, the literary critic, wrote a really wacky but interesting novel about Gnostic dualism. It's been in the air a lot in the 20th century, especially since Hans Jonas, the great German scholar of Gnosticism, wrote his groundbreaking essay comparing Gnostic dualism with 19th century nihilism. It's true that Gnosticism is always on the outside. It's always socially rebellious, and therefore we can find, as social rebels, if that's the way we think of ourselves, we could find a lot to sympathize with in it. And yes, indeed, there are modern-day Gnostic churches. They're all very small, and most of them are in California. And if you want to know more about it, I can introduce you to someone who's actually here, who's a Gnostic bishop. And he could tell you more about that. Yeah?
Can you speak a little bit more about how Neoplatonism and Gnostic dualism has affected our view of the natural world? I mean,
yes.
I don't really associate them too much with the attitude of the environment, but but I never really thought of that. So can you talk more about
yeah,
that?
Yeah. Well, if you only know, of course, classical Platonism, or for that matter, classical Neoplatonism, it might come as a surprise to you to hear me putting them on the side, even trying to put them a little bit on the side of the Greens and the pro-Earth party. But the point, or here's the point. First there was Platonism. Then Gnostic dualism came along, and the Neoplatonists had to argue with the dualists. And they had to say, wait, there are dualistic aspects to Platonism, but we're not dualists. Why not? Here's where we draw the line, okay? The line is that the earth is still good. It's not as good as the spirit, but it's not evil. So that beauty, physical beauty, for example, becomes the ladder towards, you know, philosophical realization. So you have, all right, now you've got the Neoplatonists versus the Gnostic dualists on this point. And little by little, the Platonists are being pushed into a more and more anti-dualist position until finally when you get to very late Neoplatonism, i.e. the Renaissance, the process is over. Plato, to a certain extent, has been turned on his head. And even things in Plato, and I've seen this myself, texts in Plato, which are usually read as being anti-material, are used by the Renaissance philosophers to support their idea of the nobleness of the human of the human and of the physical earth. This is a very long story. I can't tell you any one book to read that's really explored this, but if you read around in Renaissance Hermeticism, you'll come across this strange paradox of a Neoplatonism that becomes militantly anti-dualist.
Okay,
yes. Yeah.
What does the neo-dualism of Gnosticism have to do with Zoroastrianism? Where do you come from that tradition?
Zoroastrianism. Zoroastrianism is the original dualist religion. It's probable that it had a great deal of influence on Gnosticism, but in a mediated way. It's mediated through exilic Judaism. When the Jews were sent into exile in Babylon, right, and then released by Cyrus and came back to Palestine, they brought a lot of Persian and Mesopotamian ideas with them, including, for example, angels, which never appear in the Bible until after the exilic period, including Satan, who's really a very shadowy figure until after the exilic period. So what you have is, I think, more of a mediated influence from Zoroastrianism on 1st century BC to 2nd century AD Gnosticism through later Rabbinic Judaism. Does that answer your question? Yeah. Yeah.
Yes. I heard a lot about Albert Cromwell being anti-Cromwell, being anti-Catholic. I didn't know he was. How come they kept it a secret till now? I never heard of him being anti-Protestant.
Well, have you heard that Stalin and Trotsky killed off all the anarchists in Russia?
Okay.
You know, as far as I'm concerned, it's exactly the same thing. You know,
right.
You can't make an omelet without breaking eggs, but once the omelet is made, boy, no more eggs are to be broken. Yes, Bill.
I want to know a little bit about the Shakers. I thought they were kind of interesting as an offshoot, a movement that basically killed itself off, and a movement that not only eschewed patents and created many things that are now in general use, but became wealthy over something that they had absolutely no control over, which was their land.
Yeah. The Shakers, a very strange offshoot of this whole tradition. Mother Ann Lee, which was the female messiah, she came to America, founded a number of communes. Again, we have Bible communism. These are the people who made the great Shaker architecture and furniture, which I always call American Zen. It has that kind of elegant simplicity with a deep spiritual, you know, frisson to it that you get from Japanese Zen aesthetics, for example. As a sect, I think they were actually rather authoritarian. I mean, Mother Ann Lee was the messiah and the boss. They're not to be seen as having an anarchist life way themselves. But in relation to the rest of society, they were very radical, perceived as radical. They didn't marry. In fact, they claimed not to have sex at all. And so the sect could only be replaced by adoption. And they would adopt orphans, bring them up, educate them, and then give them the choice, I think when they were 16, either to go out into the world with what they'd learned
probably good furniture making at the very least, or stay within the religion. And when you say that they've killed themselves off, that is not quite true. Mm-hmm. There are, as far as I know, still two or three Shakers in this world.
And they own
handful
up in Maine. They now, due to an accident thing, many people don't know this, but Poland Spring had another name. It was called Sabbath Day Lake.
Oh yeah.
And they talk about the 400 protected acres. That was the Shaker. That's the Shaker land that it's on. The company is a profit-making company that has an agreement to mine their water,
right,
for which they are paid quite handsomely.
Right. There were many of these sects, and as I said, almost all of them were in upstate New York. There's a great book called The Burnt Over District. Anybody remember the author? Burnt Over District.
Castan?
No. Anyway, that's definitely the title. It's an overall history of upstate New York from about 1840 to 1800, immediate post-Civil War era, just listing and describing these movements one after another. Total madness. And really, really a lot of fun to read about. It makes you proud to be a New Yorker.
When I was doing history of religion in America, the professor used to talk about the different conversion exercises in the different groups and demonstrate them.
Uh-huh.
And these change over time as well.
Yeah. Well, the Shakers, of course, they shook, presumably. The pictures we see of them, they're dancing. They're always dancing. But it seems in a kind of organized-looking dance. Most of the pictures I've seen, they're in lines, you know, maybe men on one side, women on the other, and they kind of like conga line dancing. But the people saw them shake, and I think that they were all vibrating madly as they did this.
And they did it to Aaron Copland, because that's a gift to the...
Yeah. Can you talk about contemporary Mennonite culture and how it might...
Contemporary.
Yeah.
The Mennonites are eventually an offshoot of the German Anabaptists, who were Bible communists and lived together, as I said, in kind of quasi-monastic and yet, you know, sexually reproducing communes. We still have a lot of these groups, especially in Pennsylvania. The Mennonites are divided now into two groups. One are the strict order Mennonites who dress, I think that they dress old-fashioned, like the Amish, and they live in communal groups with owning everything in common. And then there's church-going Mennonites, too, who are living outside, who have, you know, support and sympathize with the communist groups, but don't practice that for whatever reason. And there's also actually a third group called the Bruderhof that are very interesting in this respect. I happen to be neighbors of the Bruderhof, so I hear about them a lot. They're an extreme left-wing Mennonite group. They're a group that's basically realized that in the 16th century they were radical leftists, and so they should update their leftism, not stick with 16th century programs, but actually adopt modern radical programs. And you run into these folks at anti-death penalty stuff,
yes.
Anti-war stuff, very sincere, very nice. They make toys for children, they do volunteer health work. No, they're good folks, as far as I can make out. A little strange and culty, perhaps. Not my taste, but, you know, hats off. Hats off.
One of them was willing to give his life instead of Mumia Abu Jamal, one of the...
Is that right?
Yeah.
Yeah, that sounds like...
He was a spiritual advisor as well.
Yeah, she says that some, one of the Bruderhof volunteered to die in the place of Mumia Abu Jamal. Yeah.
Just to share an observation someone told me recently, which seems tangentially related to this whole subject, which is that science is the most fundamentalist of all the religions.
Mm. Well, you know, Robert Anton Wilson likes to talk about fundamentalist materialists, you know, knee-jerk scientific skepticism and that kind of thing. There is an aspect, I think, to modern science where it can drift into the most ghastly dogmatism. In which the scientist, or rather, more often, the science writer, you know, the failed humanist, is going on about science uber alles. Let me give you an example from the life and work of Ivan Illich, since he's on my mind tonight. When his book Limits to Medicine came out, also called Medical Nemesis, in which he investigated modern medicine as a counterproductive monopoly. And pointed out that modern medicine tends to make you sick. He had two book reviews in England. Two very famous book reviews came out in England. One in the Times Literary Supplement, the Sunday London Times Literary Supplement. The other one in The Lancet, the Journal of the British Medical Association, the British AMA, British equivalent of AMA. Now, which, you know, all right, Illich, totally, total onslaught on organized medicine. Absolutely must, the whole thing must be torn down and rebuilt from the bottom up. It's a completely radical approach to medicine. Which of those two publications do you suppose praised the book and which attacked it? The Times Literary Supplement was like, who is this guy daring to attack science? You know, and The Lancet was like, oh, whew, at last somebody's telling the truth. We couldn't do it, no, because we're, you know, we just can't do it. But this Mr. Illich, he knows what he's talking about. He's, all his references are good. He hasn't used any footnotes from any philosophy or anything like that. It's all from medical books and medical history. We really like this book. We're really glad. Breath of fresh air. Three cheers, Mr. Illich. I think that sort of sums up what you're talking about. There's nothing, you know, hell hath no fury like a scientismist scorned. You know, there's science, and the real scientist is always at least an agnostic. You know, has always at least got an open mind. Is always at least willing to consider that what seems like absolute God's truth at this moment might turn out to be just the latest paradigm. But when you get away from those real scientists into the world of fake science writers for the New York Times, things like that, then you get the science worship, you know, the bowing to the idol of science. And that's really dangerous.
What was the name of the medicine book?
Medical Nemesis or Limits to Medicine. It has both titles. Yes?
I was reading the Adbusters recently, today, and they talked a little bit about the mistakes of the left and then the mistakes of the right and then choose something in between, and that kind of struck me that a lot of the ideas that you're talking about, I think about also, and I think a lot of what spurred me on this thought was that the constant use of the ad industry to use us to pour from within, but it's relentless.
It's totally relentless, and it's completely magical, of course. there's no way to explain how advertising works, really. It's magic. You might as well call it magic. And in fact, the great historian of religion, Ioan Culianu, who was murdered by an agent of the Romanian reaction, wrote a fascinating book called Eros and Magic in the Renaissance, in which he said, who are the real heirs, at least on the dark side of the force, who are the real heirs of the Renaissance magi? It's the advertisers, the PR men, the spin doctors, the propagandists, the educational ideologists, the mind twisters.
Who were they?
Culianu. C-O-U-L-I-A-N-O. Culianu. So this is a subject that fascinates me, and I've
I don't know my exact question. I felt frustrated reading this, and I feel like I want an answer, like do an anti-war demo, and then you find months later people are doing, you know, stencils on the street, and it's Nike or something like that. They're even doing, I don't know my question, but basically, what is something to combat that?
Something to combat this particular form of evil, as far as I see it, is to understand Hermeticism. My liberatory proposal is that we understand what's going on through Hermeticism, through the science of the manipulation of images to influence human consciousness. This is not something that we can learn about only from psychology or only from sociology. We would also learn quite a lot from Giordano Bruno and the other Renaissance magicians. We would learn about hieroglyphics, about the idea of the image and word combined, which later Walter Benjamin talks about, or Brecht, for example. We would learn about how words and images together can penetrate not only the consciousness but the unconscious on every level, different perhaps on every level, and so we can begin to get a handle on how we're being manipulated, right? Once you've got that handle, I don't know what you do with it, but at least you've got it. At least you're not just a passive schmuck anymore, you know. At least when you're watching television, you can critique what's happening to you instantly as it happens, because you have that magical training. Maybe interesting thought. Anyway, yes.
Yeah, Maybe you could tell us more about the ways that you can, the ways that you can use the Flubscher Donnelbrunn. Maybe you could tell us more about the ways that you can.
Yes, there's been a little series of books called Using Marx, Using Reich.
Oh, God, yes.
It would be nice to have a Using Bruno book, for sure. James Joyce, there's a hint for you. James Joyce was probably the leading Brunonian, or as we call it, Nolan, because Mr. Bruno was from the town of Nola. So we talk about Nolanism, or a Nolan thinker. James Joyce was probably the most outstanding Nolan of the 20th century, so there's a place you might look for more. Francis Yates, whom I mentioned before, the British historian, wrote two books relevant to Bruno. One is called Giordano Bruno, and the other one is called The Art of Memory. Bruno is a fairly well-studied, although in my opinion, completely not very well understood philosopher. So there's a lot of academic horseshit, which I suggest you probably skip and go right to Bruno's own writings, which are some of which are now available in English.
What do you think about your book, Man in Flames?
I don't know.
It's a fiction book about Giordano Bruno.
Oh, yeah? By who?
I can entirely forget.
Man in Flames. Well, that's a perfect title, of course.
That's what
that's
I
yes, that's, yeah. I'll look for it. I'll look for it. Yeah. Thank you. Yes.
Looking at certain relationships, from what I understand, between spiritualism and anarchism, and perhaps one relating to the other in a historic sense. But I'm trying to understand the way I've always seen a religion was sort of a byproduct of culture, which is a sort of sociological phenomenon, which is drawn perhaps from our passions, but something to do with the way society is structured and its sort of
notion. So basically Weber, you're giving us?
That's what I'm saying is, if you just studies into the, what I'm asking is, how you studies in spiritualism, are they geared towards understanding the philosophy of religion, whether it has any place in religion?
Sorry?
Does it have to do with your study of the philosophy of religion, perhaps? And where it has a place politically with anarchism. I'm trying to better understand how you're trying to try to fit that within. I've always seen things from a scientific point of view that it's just a sociological byproduct. I'm trying to
an epiphenomenon.
Right.
Well, the sheer overwhelming amount of human activity to these areas would seem to suggest that we're looking at something more than a mere this or a mere that, you know, no matter what we put after the word mere. So, I mean,
it's also we just haven't come up with a sufficient explanation.
I suppose you could say that. This is why I'm calling my talks Topics for Research. Try Max Weber, if you haven't already. He's an interesting sociologist of religion who gives it a little bit more position than epiphenomenal mereness.
I didn't mean to trivialize it.
No, I understand what you're saying. I think it's an ongoing problem. I couldn't begin to address that in a few words. Yeah. Oh, you wait a minute. Anybody who hasn't gone already? Yes.
Yeah. This is. I'm interested in the internal dynamics of these various groups that you've been describing.
Mm.
How egalitarian were they in terms of men, women, adults, children, insiders, outsiders?
Yeah.
Was there a big variety? And how much do you think? I don't know if you can generalize, they depended on a single charismatic leader or whether that was spread around.
Mm. Of course, every single possible variation can be found. I would say that, I mean, obviously some heresies are incredibly authoritarian within themselves, and we have only to look at modern-day cults to see how that can go. And that's not to condemn all modern cults, it's just to point out that some of them go that way. You know, some of them go the Jonestown route. No point in denying it. It really does happen, and it always has happened that a closed cult can become a very nasty, authoritarian pot of stew within itself. You know, self-enclosed little horror. It's not, however, always the case. Not by any means is it always the case. And it would be impossible, I think, to predict it on the basis of the ideology or the spiritual teaching, how it would turn out. Because even some sects which seem to be preaching a rather authoritarian guru-oriented line, you know, actually when you study the way the people within that group live, they seem quite free and cheerful, you know. Whereas other groups that begin perhaps with a much more non-authoritarian dogma or teaching somehow flip and end up paradoxically, you know, especially when there's a little power involved in turning it around. So things flip back and forth all the time. I mean, the whole thing about human freedom is that it's so evanescent, and it's like the butterfly that can't be pinned down without, you know, destroying the whole possibility of studying what life itself might be, as Goethe used to say when he was talking about the bug collectors of his day. If you kill it in order to study it, then you're studying death, not life. So in order to kill one of these sects, so to speak, to pin it to the board of history and to try to study it in that way is problematic, sometimes impossible, because we're not inside the consciousness of those people. And it's only through a kind of a, it's only by getting away from the strict disciplines of history and drifting into the demonic area that I spoke of at the end of my talk that we might begin to be able to intuit the inner life of these people in the past or in the distance. I don't like to make judgments. I don't like to make judgments because it's very hard to say what moment it is for any given human being that produces that spark, that flame, that opening. It could come from so many different places, and some of them places that we don't like particularly, that we don't approve of, but nevertheless somehow that spark comes out of it.
Quick follow-up is, do you have any theories or observations about what internally might cause an anarchist group or proto-anarchist group to have a internally democratic and spread out power structure versus those that were more hierarchical? Gosh. Do you have any observations, theories, or comments on
that? I have lots of observations, as I'm sure you do, because you've noted that this phenomenon exists. It's socially embarrassing in the left to have to talk about these things, you know. And as a result, they're not talked about very much, and not a great deal of thinking has gone into it, and therefore the psychology of, you know, I have to say, much as I dislike certain other aspects of the document, there's some very interesting little aperçus in the Unabomber Manifesto about the psychology of the left. I don't even like a lot of what he says, but it's an interesting critique. It deserves to be answered seriously, unlike other aspects of that document. I could cop out and just say the answer is human cussedness. You know, that as the book says, human beings are born to trouble as the sparks fly upwards, and they're liars and deceitful, and there's no truth in them. But I won't say that either.
I may have missed it while I was going around with the box, but I didn't hear you, I think, mention the whole Dorothy Day and up to Philip Berrigan, who was the other priest who died recently, along with Illich.
Yeah. Yes. Oh, I didn't know.
Yes. Yeah, he just died like a week ago.
Really?
Yeah. Gosh. And he's in that tradition. I don't know whether he ever called himself a Catholic worker, but the fact that Jonah House was set up and very much on the
mark. Well, he hung out with him anyway.
Yeah. Except that they said that Dorothy Day was loyal to the Chancery. When the Chancery summoned her, she went.
Well, maybe so. Francis.
Hey, Dorothy Day is about to become a goddamn saint.
And it's O'Connor. I mean, who's that?
Although the people over at the Catholic Worker are always saying she would never have wanted to be classified that
way. I would think probably not. You know, another interesting character is Eamon Hennessy, who wrote, the friend of Dorothy Day's, who wrote a very nice book on spiritual anarchism, in which he talked about groups like the Duchoborists, for example, the Russian spiritual anarchists who would take their clothes off and burn their own houses down. It's part of their spiritual practice.
There was just a woman up in jail, an old woman in Canada, I think.
Yeah, a lot
precisely
of them,
for yes. for burning her house down
That's
and going
right.
around naked, and she showed up in court naked.
That's right, Dave. A lot of them were thrown out of Russia, and they went to Canada, and the Canadian government said, Russian peasants, good. They're farmers, good. They didn't know what they were getting themselves into.
There's a book about them by George Woodcock.
Yeah, that's right. A nice book by George Woodcock on the Dukhobors. And I remember my old acquaintance, Harry Smith, the surrealist filmmaker, hunchback, dwarf, Gnostic bishop, beatnik surrealist, used to say that when he was being brought up in the Northwest, his mother used the Dukhobors as the boogeyman.
Harry, if you don't eat your supper, the Dukhobors will get you.
Yeah, that's right. Yes.
Is there any connection between the Theosophical Society and any of the
hippies? Absolutely, yeah. Yes, absolutely. Not that Madame Blavatsky or any of the other leaders were particularly non-authoritarian in their approach to reality, but the Theosophical Society got to be so widespread and diffuse a thing that both left, right, center, everything eventually turns up in Theosophy.
They all met at Monte Verita, Switzerland.
Yeah.
Organization?
Pardon?
Is it like a
hierarchical? Oh, yeah, sure, yeah. I have very mixed feelings about the Theosophists. I think, you know, Blavatsky was an amazingly wonderful charlatan and liar. Bazant bores me. Ledbetter is a joke. Yeats, you know, when Yeats starts to take it seriously, then maybe I begin to at least look on it as a possible source of inspiration. But eventually, Theosophy is just at the root of every spiritual movement, especially mystical occult movement since then. I mean, whatever else you might say about Madame, she was an incredibly influential figure. And there's just no way of studying any of the things I've talked about in the 20th century, late 19th, early 20th century, without a tip to her crackpot ideas, you know. The Theosophical Enlightenment.
Jocelyn Godwin.
G-O-D-W-I-N.
Photograph of her
health. Yes, those eyes and the cigarette.
The
Turkish cigarette in the eyes. She's a great character, really a great character. I still think that no one's dared to write really the ultimate Blavatsky biog. I mean, just the amount of hashish she's probably smoked in Egypt to produce the Veil of Isis. I've heard rumors, you know, but I've never seen it in print. We got to start wrapping it up, so I'll try to get people who haven't spoken yet. I think you're one.
It's fair to say something about the transcendentalists and, you know, and what they have to do with spiritualism.
Sure. The transcendentalists, the American transcendentalists. I did briefly mention Thoreau. I could also mention that the Brook Farm, the famous transcendentalist commune in Massachusetts, adopted Charles Fourier's ideas about association and utopian socialism and combined the European socialist tradition with the American transcendentalist position. This was Emerson. This is when Emerson lost interest, and also Hawthorne. But people like Park Godwin and some of the lesser well-known transcendentalists. And Brook Farm was a very happy place. I've read a lot about Brook Farm, trying to figure out exactly what to get inside. We were talking about getting inside the spirit, getting inside the minds of people in the past. Because they were so literate, they wrote, all of them had kept diaries, wrote letters, journals.
Walcott was there, right?
Yeah. They were all there. They all passed through one time or another. And we can know a lot about the consciousness at Brook Farm. And it was a beautiful, happy place, I think. Really very, very interesting experiment. One of the most interesting 19th century experiments in practical socialism. Yes, the links are obviously there. Transcendentalism was part of the great American reform movement of the mid-19th century. So although there were some members of it who were pretty crusty and not really all that socially radical, You know, they were, some of them were even Christian ministers. Emerson himself began as a Unitarian minister, although he left the church. On the other hand, or I should say on the other wing, there was a great deal of transcendentalism that feeds right into what I've been talking about. And in this sense, I would say it is American Romanticism. It's the American Romantic movement, and needs to be seen in that context in order to fully appreciate its political oomph. I could go on, but that would be my approach to further study. Okay, someone who hasn't said anything. Did you speak already?
No, I didn't.
Yeah, okay.
I mentioned earlier that I'm a musician. I'm also...
Well, that's why I thought you said something earlier.
Yeah. I'm also a Muslim, and uh-huh. I do volunteer work as an imam with the New York City Department of Corrections.
Gosh.
Tell me about it. To complicate matters, I have never made any exclusive allegiance to any one Islamic group.
No reason why you should.
Yeah.
I mean, within the philosophy of Islam itself, there's no reason why you should. Every Muslim is his or her own imam. This is known. This is well understood. There is no pope. There is no pope, and there is no church hierarchy. Shiism, okay. Things get a little questionable there. Although the hierarchy in Shiism is not self-chosen. It emerges from the community in a very interesting process.
That's how I became an imam. It wasn't my idea at all.
Uh-huh. So I would say again, you know, I set out here to talk mostly about Christianity, just because that's, you know, the usual field that we find ourselves in. But I could have said a lot about the Islamic tradition. I could have mentioned certain tendencies within Sufism, Ismailism. I could have mentioned the Spanish Mouridin of the 12th, 13th century. I could have mentioned. Modern Islamic socialist thinkers like Ali Shariati or even Muammar Gaddafi. And if you're shocked to hear me mention his name in this room, I would suggest you go to the Libyan office at the UN and ask for a copy of his Green Book and read it. You'll be absolutely shocked to discover the situationist influence, the ghost of Colin Wilson passing Green through.
Remember to chase it with the latest Atlas International report on Libya.
I began by saying that I was not supporting anything that I've mentioned here. Okay? So a mention of something is not tantamount or equal to a support for it. Okay? Have you read the Green Book, Bill?
Yeah, I've looked at it.
You've looked
at it. It's green.
Now read the section on organized sports. It could have been written by Guy Debord. I think we better wrap it up. I know I'd like to go on. You're a great audience. I really appreciate it.
You've been listening to a lecture and discussion by Peter Lamborn Wilson on spiritual anarchism, given last month in New York City. Thanks to Patty Heffley for providing us with this tape. Ithaca Community Radio will be holding its second public meeting to discuss the ongoing plans to create a community radio station in the Ithaca area. The meeting will be held next Saturday, January 11th, from 11 to 1 at the Borg Warner Room of the Tompkins County Public Library. The library is located in downtown Ithaca at the corner of Cayuga and Green Streets. Following the meeting, workshops on radio production will be held at venues nearby. For more information, contact Jesse Lind at 607-273-0532 or attend the general meeting for more details. For more information on Ithaca Community Radio and how to get involved, visit www.ithacaradio.org.
Our theme music, Unwelcome Guest, is performed by Billy Bragg and Wilco, with lyrics by Woody Guthrie. Unwelcome Guests is produced by Chris Sturr, Jesse Lind, Lynn Gary, and Sean Ewald. We are solely responsible for its content.